Trigger warning, this episode talks about Frollo, and that gets into some issues of consent. If that's not something you want to deal with, you probably don't want to watch this episode.
Welcome once again to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jackson Eflin.
This week, we'll be going over Cinderella and Hunchback of Notre Dame. Why don't we go ahead and get into synopses right away? So, Cinderella. The story starts, Cinderella's stepmother, Lady Tremaine, has squandered her late husband's fortunes on luxuries for herself and her daughters, forcing Cinderella to become a scullery maid to earn her keep. Cinderella's grown somewhat accustomed to the situation. She's helped by her animal friends, who she feeds and clothes. Meanwhile, the king is dissatisfied that his son has yet to marry and give him grandchildren. He orders the Grand Duke to organize a ball and invite every eligible maiden in the kingdom. While Cinderella's allowed to attend the ball, her stepmother includes the stipulation that she has to finish all of her chores. Lady Tremaine and her daughters conspire against her by giving her extra chores, and then destroy the dress that her animal friends altered for her. Distraught, Cinderella runs to the garden, to cry, where her fairy godmother appears, and uses her magic to give Cinderella transportation and proper attire for the ball. And also a warning that the magic will only last until midnight. At the ball, the prince is immediately awestruck by Cinderella, and they end up dancing the night away. However, when Cinderella is alerted to the time, she runs off, without giving the prince her name, but leaving behind a glass slipper. Conveniently, the only item not to disappear at midnight. The Duke is then charged to find the mystery woman by having all the maidens in the kingdom try on the slipper. Once again, Lady Tremaine attempts to keep Cinderella from the prince and locks her in the tower while her daughters try on the slipper. Cinderella is freed by her animal friends and produces the other slipper to prove she's the mystery woman from the ball. She and the prince marry. Roll credits.
Meanwhile, Hunchback of Notre Dame is loosely inspired by Victor Hugo's novel Notre Dame de Paris. Quasimodo's sinister guarding Judge Claude Frollo keeps him penned in the Notre Dame Cathedral, ringing the bells. One day, he sneaks out to attend the Romani festival, the Feast of Fools. A grimacing contest starts up, and he is crowned the King of Fools for his deformed face. The celebration turns to anguish when the guard turns the crowd against him. Then, the beautiful Esmeralda, a dancer with the Romani, defends him. She turns to a public castigation of Frollo. When the guards attempt to accost her, she seeks sanctuary in Notre Dame. Quasimodo helps her escape, and Frollo, consumed with lust, goes on a rampage to find her. Various characters move from place to place, with the upshot being that Esmeralda is captured, the guard Captain Phoebus turns on Frollo and refuses to participate in the genocide, and Quasimodo realizes that Frollo is a monster. As Frollo attempts to execute Esmeralda, Quasimodo metaphorically and literally breaks his chains and rescues her. Frollo falls to his death, Quasimodo is accepted by the populace, and Esmeralda hooks up with Phoebus. The end!
So, may not look at it on the surface, but some oddly similar themes in both of these films.
Yeah. I mean, really, they're both about a person who is kept in a location by their guardian who uses and abuses them, and they eventually find their freedom by deprogramming themselves one way or another.
All right. Do we want to start with Cinderella or Hunchback first?
Honestly, I kind of want to just, like, talk about the themes of abuse dynamics. What would you call it?
Abuse, authoritarian parents.
Yeah.
There's kind of a thin line there, but I do think that there's a bit of a distinction.
Yeah, and I mean, both Lady Tremaine and Frollo definitely cross it.
Yes, and to a certain extent, the king does too with the prince, although not nearly to the extent the other do.
We talked about how the king is at least somewhat manipulative of his son in ways that are a little uncomfortable. Admittedly, it's mostly just ushering him towards eligible bachelorettes because he really wants grandchildren. And that's kind of why I'm sort of okay with the prince and Ella getting together in Cinderella. They both have parents who prioritize their own needs over their children's. And while it's not really gone into, it's at least a thing that you can, I guess, fan canon your way into making sense of.
Yeah, that's fair. I don't know. It's really difficult to give a shit about the prince. He does not have any characterization. He barely has speaking lines.
Mm-hmm. His first line is just half a verse in the Falling in Love song. He doesn't seem actively involved in the search for the mystery woman. That seems to be mostly the Duke and the King.
Yeah, they honestly could have alleviated a lot of the problems by having the prince being the one to actively search for the mystery woman.
On the one hand, it makes sense that having the Duke do it means he would not recognize Cinderella's face and therefore wouldn't need the slipper to figure things out, but also, if the prince was just there, that would have solved the whole problem.
Well, it looks like we're focusing on Cinderella quite a bit, so why don't we just go ahead and finish going down that rabbit hole?
Sure. Speaking of rabbit holes, the plot is divided between the summer you got and then also the mice and the cat running around.
Yeah, it feels like they tried to shove an episode of Tom and Jerry into this film while also keeping all the Cinderella bits. I don't think it works.
On the one hand, you have this thing where the mice running around grabbing cheese, befuddling the cat, winds up being a skill they're developing over time to be able to do that at the end to rescue Cinderella when she's locked in the attic. But there were probably easier ways to work around that, like having someone else get her out of the attic. It kind of reads like a superhero team, you know, coming together at the end to defeat the villain with the skills they've picked up, but it goes on way too long and doesn't really feel like it feeds into that well.
Yeah, which is really unfortunate because the mice are probably some of the best characters in the film. Jacques and Gus Gus are great when we aren't subjected to these overly long slapstick routines between them and Lucifer the cat.
There's some really fun creative stuff when the mice are doing the sewing and that kind of thing. Like, oh, cool, I can see all the thought that was put into how these small creatures would create this large construct. It's a lot of visual creativity.
This film has a lot of similarities to Snow White on a number of levels. Firstly, just critical reception-wise, it was their biggest success since Snow White. This is actually the film that bailed the Disney company out post-World War II. They had a number of flops with Fantasia, Pinocchio, and Bambi during World War II, and they were in quite a bit of debt. But Cinderella was actually sort of their Cinderella story, ironically enough. But it does suffer a lot of the same problems that Snow White does. There's a lot of slapstick humor that's shoved in and doesn't really move the plot forward, leading to this really stretched out, just jointed film. And unfortunately, in comparison to Snow White, there aren't these breathtaking visuals. That might be due to the fact that we were watching the Blu-ray edition and it had been digitally remastered and scrubbed of a lot of line work, but unfortunately, that's the most available version that we could find.
Mm-hmm. There are a few sequences that stick out, like the fairy godmother creating all the accoutrements for Cinderella. There's some really fun transformation sequence things, and I know that Walt Disney's favorite animation sequence was the ragged dress into the ball gown. But on the other hand, you have some weird animation stuff, like when Cinderella is weeping on the bench and the fairy godmother appears beneath her, but where Cinderella's head is doesn't change, so she's like flat in that bit. It's a cool visual effect, but if you think about it too hard, it falls apart.
I will say probably the most like artistically stunning point of the film is the bubble montage while Snow White is singing and washing the floors.
Well, who is washing the floors?
Did I say Snow White?
You did say Snow White. I understand why. They're interchangeable a little bit. And while I agree with you, that scene also doesn't really go anywhere. It's beautiful, but the plot kind of stops there. When you have the plot stopping for the mice, you at least get the fun slapstick. With that, it's just, here's some lovely visuals, and I would have loved to have character development there.
We do also get a little bit of slapstick with the stepsisters, which is kind of interesting since you don't often see women in slapstick roles, especially during this period.
Yeah, and the slapstick there really pays off because you have the two sisters who are punching each other and hitting each other with flutes and tugging each other's clothes, and then later Tremaine will say, "Quiet!" And it's deadly calm, and the way that the slapstick just goes away and you're like, oh, she means business, makes her seem like a bigger threat than she otherwise might be.
Yeah, they do a really great job of casting Lady Tremaine as a villain with just tone and use of lighting. Even though, for the most part, she's very low tier when you're thinking of Disney villains, she has this very powerful presence.
It helps that her voice actress also, I believe, is the same voice actress as Maleficent. And it's impressive that she manages to achieve all this without any kind of magic. They didn't go the route of making her a witch or something, and I think the film is stronger for that.
I will say that there's a huge cultural significance to just the phrase bibbidi-bobbidi-boo. Those words have entered not just our culture, but cultures all over the globe. I mean, you have Dragon Ball Z villains who are named after those phrases.
Really?
Yes.
This is an example of the film where, again, the protagonist doesn't really solve the problems. The characters solve the problems around her. And I think that makes it less strong because you don't feel that the protagonist has an active role in her own story.
Yeah, it is really frustrating. A lot of early Disney princess films sort of have this problem where they just kind of have these princesses and other people solve their problems for them. There's also some other weird stuff going on, getting back to the Bibbidi-Bobbidi-Boo scene, where the fairy godmother just is like, oh, hey, you're a horse? Well, you're going to be a human now. Hey, you're a bunch of mice? Well, you're going to be horses now. And there are some weird issues with bodily autonomy, especially since Gus Gus runs away, not wanting to be turned into a horse, and then they catch him and turn him into a horse anyway?
Yeah, and I think if Cinderella had just asked, it would have been fine, or if the fairy godmother had asked, that would have been fine, but they don't, and I think that in a movie about a woman trying to, you know, make her own decisions and not have to constantly do chores, it would be good for them to not have other characters forced into servitude by powers beyond their control. A small pedant corner thing. It doesn't really matter, but I kind of wish we knew why Cinderella has a fairy godmother or why she waited all this time to do something about it. There is a bit where Cinderella is saying, oh no, it's all hopeless, and she's kind of giving up on her dreams. That's when the fairy godmother shows up, which there could be something to that, but I feel like waiting till she gives up on her dreams is maybe not as important as stopping her from being a literal slave.
Yeah, from the way the story's told, it sounds like Cinderella has been this scullery maid without pay for Lady Tremaine and her daughters for the better part of a decade. So it is a little odd that the fairy godmother hasn't stepped in before now. There's one other thing that I think is probably worth talking about. The mean girl archetype that the stepsisters portray here and how that archetype has evolved since 1950 when this film was released. So the stepsisters in this film are definitely portrayed as not the most conventionally attractive women.
They're called the Ugly Stepsisters. That's their name. There's the Ugly and Stepsisters.
Yeah, but the thing is, they're not even portrayed as that ugly in the film. They just kind of have not a button nose, and their singing voices aren't all that great.
Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely played up in comparison to Cinderella, who is blonde, has a button nose, gorgeous singing voice, tiny feet.
Tiny feet.
And it's just interesting to see that juxtaposed with the mean girl archetype of today, which is very vain, vapid, typically very beautiful and concerned with their looks, but still has this awful personality and always putting other people down, especially those they consider a threat to their beauty or popularity.
Mm-hmm. And especially if you look at, say, Beauty and the Beast, you have the three Gaston fans, the ones in yellow, red, and green, who were very conventionally beautiful, a lot like Cinderella was, who were portrayed as kind of bimbo-y, I guess, would be a way to put it, and how Disney's attitudes have evolved away from beauty equals goodness as a concept.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least moved away from traditional beauty as opposed to kind of unintentional beauty. That if you're trying to be beautiful, that's a problem, almost.
Mm. And I mean, I kind of think we see an even further evolution of this with Hans in Frozen, where he is a very handsome, well-behaved prince, and he ends up becoming one of the major antagonists of that film.
Mm-hmm.
Do we really have anything more to talk about Cinderella? I think I'm kind of exhausted.
I mean, I think apart from just, you know, don't trust pretty people, which, you know, we knew this. Oh, there is one more thing that I will never not want to talk about. Two thoughts that we'll put next to each other and see what happens with that. Cinderella does pass the Bechdel test. It passes the Bechdel test repeatedly. Cinderella talks to her stepmother and her stepsisters. The stepsisters talk to each other and their mother. Cinderella talks to the fairy godmother, etc. And honestly, there aren't a lot of movies even today that pass the Bechdel test. I don't know if any of the recent Disney princess ones do apart from maybe Frozen, but on the other hand, you have that line during the sewing sequence where one of the mice is like, leave the sewing to the women. And I'm like, oh, right, this was made in the 50s. So this is one of those cases where the feminism of the film is touch and go as opposed to being entirely regressive as other things have been.
There is some other credence to some of the feminist ideals with this film. all of the female characters that have speaking roles have actual names. Cinderella, Lady Tremaine, Anastasia, and Drusilla, the stepsisters. But with
the fairy godmother, but...
Yeah, I guess that's kind of a title. But all of the male human characters in the credits are just labeled as the king, the grand duke. And I do believe it's Prince Charming, but I'm not sure if they ever actually say his name during the film.
This is definitely a story about women and women helping other women, which is nice.
Building off that, there is the king's sort of fixation with having grandchildren, not necessarily specifically to preserve the monarchy and make sure someone winds up on the throne if his son should die, but he literally has daydreams about playing horsey with his theoretical grandchildren. And it's not something that you would typically see portrayed in a male character during this time period.
Right, and he isn't portrayed as foppish or like a sissy villain or anything. He's like, he runs around with a sword and rages at the Grand Duke and threatens executions and stuff, but he also wants grandchildren. I like him a lot, actually. I watch a movie just about him.
So, Hunchback of Notre Dame. Once again, I do want to point out that this is a G-rated film.
So, the goat smokes, quite raunchy shadows when Esmeralda is dancing. There's the bit where Frollo sniffs her hair. There's the bit where Esmeralda says, "I know what you're imagining," as Frollo is pressed up against her. There's the bit where Frollo falls into a fiery hell pit of Paris. G-rated.
Yep. Jax and I had a long discussion after we found out this film was also G-rated. There's a strong argument that this film should be rated PG-13.
Yeah, definitely a hard PG.
But with that questionable decision by the movie ratings board out of the way.
Oh, also the slurs. Slurs everywhere bit.
Yes.
So this is one of the things that isn't talked about that much. The G word that is used for most of this film for the Romani peoples is in fact a slur, and we should move away from using that where possible.
Yeah. I mean, there's the whole historical accuracy component, and the Romani people are definitely being persecuted here. It makes sense for them to use a slur to refer to them, just like it makes sense for the use of the slur in Huckleberry Finn. But it still does make the film uncomfortable for those in the know about the status of that G word.
There's also, you know, other issues of race and color here, and we'll see how much we get into that, but just we acknowledge that's a problem with the film.
So, with all the content warnings out of the way, this film is gorgeous.
This film is so pretty.
The months that they spent in Paris studying Notre Dame paid off. So far, a lot of the Disney Renaissance films, we talked a lot about their use of lighting and how it doesn't always work. Here, the lighting is spot on. It is great. You have these scenes where you've got this colored light coming through the stained glass. Mm. You have lots of fire in this film that casts these wonderful shadows and orange glows. A lot of time actually passes in this film, so we get scenes during the day, scenes during the evening, scenes at night. And all of those scenes actually feel different as opposed to the night scenes just having this blue filter over everything.
There's some wonderful purples in this movie. In one of the opening shots looking out over Paris, all the roofs are some variants of purple, navy, or a green. The whole thing has a certain purple cast to it, partially because it's the dawn, and it's absolutely lovely looking. In the same way you have a scene, I think it's during Heaven's Light, or possibly Out There, where the sky is this purplish blue with a golden white light of the sun coming up just below the horizon, and Quasimodo is seen from the back as only a silhouette, and it's a lovely scene. Same thing with all the beautiful golds and reds during God Help the Outcasts and all the fierce reds and grays in Hellfire.
Moving on from just the color palette and whatnot, the animations for this film are also really great. You have a lot of action-oriented scenes with Quasimodo parkouring all over the place on top of Notre Dame Cathedral. You have Esmeralda's dance scene. There's a number of different fight scenes. All of them are really beautifully choreographed.
This is one where they really use CGI well. It feels fairly seamless. I mean, sure, you can tell if you're looking for it, but it feels like they finally figured out how to use CGI to create backgrounds and environments without putting it right up in your face.
Again, with Esmeralda here, we have the Disney woman can't have noses thing going on. So that is a ding towards the art department, although most of the other characters' designs are pretty varied and interesting.
Furlough has this angular nose like a fleur-de-lis, and it's cool and a weird visual motif.
I will admit, considering the source material, it's a little weird how much they've tried to pretty up Quasimodo.
Grading on a curve, Disney men, or at least Disney leading men, usually have the same kind of no-face syndrome that a lot of the princesses have. For me, it's not so much the visual, but it's the voice. His voice feels very young. I'm not sure why, but it feels atonal. I feel like his voice ought to be lower.
Yeah, I will admit that his voice definitely adds to that kind of, like, quiet, emotional, sensitive boy aesthetic.
And he's very sensitive. I like Quasimodo a lot as a person. He's gentle and understanding, and when he realizes that he's wrong about a thing, he learns from that instead of, you know, doubling down on it.
Yeah, honestly, all of the characterizations in this film make sense. All the characters have their own motivations, and they are consistent throughout the film, and all of the characters feel very different from each other.
I'll ding you on Clopin, the leader of the Romani, who is very mercurial. I'm never sure where he's coming from or what he wants. And I think that is almost intentional, but in a movie where all these characters have very strong intentions and goals, he feels a little bit too off-kilter.
That's fair, but I barely consider Clopin a character in this film. He's more of a narrator plot device. I mean, the gargoyles have more character than he does.
God damn it, I thought about it again. So, while I'm taking this fucking shot, do you want to explain why I'm angry about the gargoyles?
So, as we were watching, a thought occurred to me about two-thirds of the way through the film. There are three gargoyles in the film. They're actually really great plot device to move a lot of Quasimodo's internal monologue to external dialogue. I always love when films do that. I said the same thing about having Ned in the last Spider-Man film. But one of the gargoyles, Hugo, who is actually named after the author of the original work, has a crush on Jolly, the goat that Esmeralda has as a companion. Now, in the original source material, Jolly is a female goat. However, Esmeralda does specifically refer to Jolly as he earlier in the film, meaning Hugo, who we can only assume is a male or identifies as a male gargoyle, has an infatuation with another male character. Meaning that Hugo is, at this point in time, the closest we have to a canon queer character in a Disney film.
So, this is, in effect, a be careful what you wish for. I'm always wishing for more queer rep in things, especially mainstream things, and we got it. It's here now. We have Hugo, the Jason Alexander gargoyle, the I'm listening to a bird guy, as possibly the best queer character Disney has to offer. Yay.
To whichever one of you used that monkey paw to get more queer rep, I bless you. You have no idea the amount of joy that Jackson's reaction has brought me. I thank you so much.
On the other hand, speaking of, like, literally anything else, Esmeralda is so far one of my favorite characters in any of the movies we watched. I love that she is earnest and that she challenges authority. The bit where Furlough's like, silence! Justice! Is wonderful. Like, we need more characters like that. In the same way, I like her banter with Phoebus, because Phoebus growing to realize that, no, what Furlough is doing is wrong. Taking orders is the wrong thing here. I need to rebel against this. And it's also a really good thing for people in a position of power to realize that they're on the wrong side and need to break with that to help the downtrodden. Quasimodo realizing that Furlough is a monster, calling him out on that directly and specifically, and the literal and metaphorical chain breaking where he frees himself from Notre Dame in order to rescue Esmeralda is really cool to see. Disney has a running habit of telling stories of abuse and liberation from abuse, and this is a really good one.
This is definitely the most anti-cop Disney film that I've seen. However, I do feel that the themes of justice are a little undercut by some of the other choices that Disney's made. I will talk about the casting choice for Esmeralda's voice actor.
Oh, yeah.
Who is Demi Moore, who, as far as I'm aware, has no connection to the Romani people. And having this Romani character who is standing up for people and the injustice that they have been on the receiving end of, I think it muddies the waters a little bit about those themes. While we're on the subject of problematic things. Why don't we just go ahead and talk about Frollo?
Are you talking about Frollo as a very, like, rape culture-y character?
I mean, yes, considering that in my notes I just have Frollo is rape culture and just started marking tallies whenever he personified it. I won't necessarily say it's problematic in the film, it's just that the character is problematic in the fact that he is causing this evil. But he's a villain, he's kind of supposed to do that.
I would definitely not describe that as problematic. I mean, it is, you know, it is a problem the characters have to deal with, but I think showing that this kind of attitude is bad is a really good idea, and it's portrayed in a very specific gendered and racialized way, which is a fairly nuanced exploration of the desire to possess and or destroy that a lot of men feel towards women, especially white men towards women of color.
Mm-hmm.
They portray him as this icky character without making him in any way magical. They could have made him a wicked sorcerer, not just because that's a Disney archetype, but also because in the books, he's an alchemist. He's objectively trying to find the sorcerer's stone that he thinks is hidden in Notre Dame. There's like 4 chapters about that, but they didn't. They just made him a normal man consumed with lust and all the horror that can bring. I think that was a really smart move.
It's also very interesting that the 3 main male characters, Quasimodo, Phoebus, and Frollo, all view Esmeralda as a love interest, and all 3 of them model that in very different ways. 2 of them are much more healthy than the other. Although, I think we do kind of need to talk about the Phoebus, Esmeralda, Quasimodo love triangle. It feels a little forced in the film.
Yeah. I wouldn't mind it if there wasn't so much else going on, but because there is, I don't know if we needed it to be as severe. It also has this weird thing where the gargoyles seem to think that Quasimodo needs love of a person as opposed to love of the people, and that leads to that one song.
In the film, there's a song called A Guy Like You, sung by the gargoyles to Quasimodo about how he kind of deserves romantic love, and they're kind of pushing him towards pursuing Esmeralda. Prior to this song, Quasimodo really only views Esmeralda as a friendship, but afterwards he becomes infatuated with her and kind of butts heads with Phoebus over who is deserving of her affections. Now, part of our problems with this is it forces this love triangle that I don't think is really necessary, and I don't feel that it makes the film stronger. The other major problem with this song is the mood whiplash you get because of its placement. This song comes immediately after Phoebus is shot on horseback while running from Frollo and the other town guards after refusing to burn down a mill with a peasant family inside.
The song is not awful. They do manage to find a rhyme for croissant, and that's impressive on its own, but it should have been earlier in the film. It should have been a thing you put in before things got really dark, because you don't need to go from, no, I will not burn down this house with people inside it, to Hugo, a gargoyle, in drag. And then it whips right back from that to the real plot, and it feels like it didn't need to be there. It feels like someone decided that ought to be put in later on and added it in.
And then kind of in the aftermath, as they're trying to nurse Phoebus's wound, there's some tender moments between Phoebus and Esmeralda, even though Phoebus is unconscious at this point. And during the song, Quasimodo gets the Ace of Hearts from the gargoyles, and as he sees those tender moments, he kind of tears the card in half and drops it to the floor, and it is the most heavy-handed metaphor that I have ever seen.
It's a pity, because either right before or right after, he sees Esmeralda being tender with Phoebus and slumps against a pillar, and I'm like, oh, that's all I need. I can see his entire emotion played out in his face and his body language. I don't need any kind of song or dialogue to tell me what he's feeling. And then the card and the...
And it's really sad that that metaphor is so heavy-handed when there are so many other more subtle, interesting visual cues. However, not about Quasimodo's love interest, but about his perception of self and the abuse that Frollo puts him through.
Oh, yeah. Like, in an early scene, Frollo has Quasimodo get flatware for a meal, and Frollo is given this beautiful metal cup and a lovely plate, whereas Quasimodo has to use just a wooden plate and a wooden cup. And it's not directly remarked upon in the movie. It's just a very quick visual cue.
There's also, if you take a look at a lot of the miniatures that Quasimodo has made of the townspeople, many of them are incredibly detailed and very close likenesses of the people that they are trying to portray. Whereas Quasimodo's is very rough, his arms sink down and back into the base, his hair is very tuft-like, it doesn't actually model his own hair very well, and it gives you this look into Quasimodo's perception of himself and how monstrous and unbeautiful that he feels that he is due to Frollo's prolonged abuse.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's very subtle and important about him thinking of himself as not monstrous is when Esmeralda has a conversation with him on the roof about what people think of other people and how they can be wrong about that. And he starts thinking of himself as beautiful in a way that's talked about as a feeling, not about a visual thing. He talks about how it feels like heaven's light as opposed to I suddenly think I look good. And I think that talking about beauty as an internal feeling of self-worth as opposed to an external evaluatable quality is a really important subtle change, especially in a narrative about abuse.
Mm-hmm. It also really ties into a lot of the fire and light themes throughout this film. Even just the juxtaposition of heaven's light versus hellfire as songs in the film is really poignant. But I think one of the biggest pitfalls of the climax of the film is the have it both ways death scene with Esmeralda.
The, oh, she's dead. Oh, wait, no, she's fine.
Yeah, it feels really cheap.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll admit that the way Esmeralda is sidelined for the entire end fight thing is also kind of cheap since she's generally a very active character. There's a lot of things where they didn't quite know how to end Esmeralda's arc.
I think, unfortunately, overall, the fumbled climax pulls the film as a whole down a little bit.
Yeah, it's not awful, but it feels like they could have done that in a more subtle way.
Especially considering how strong the earlier parts of the film were.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we've seen their talent, I just don't know why it wasn't used here. It's getting to be about that time. We should probably make our final decision. What do you think moves on this week?
It's honestly kind of a hard one for me. Like, I like both the movies. I'm not sure if the problems of Hunchback bring it down below the consistently competent, I guess-ness of Cinderella.
I will admit, going into this week, I really didn't know where my vote was going to go. In the past, I've been a pretty vocal opponent of Hunchback. It's not one of my favorite films. I do think watching it again with a more critical eye made me appreciate it quite a bit more. And in comparison to Cinderella, which has a lot of the same pitfalls that early Disney films do, I think my vote is going to go towards Hunchback.
I just remember that bit during the Festival of Fools where Esmeralda's doing her dance and Frollo goes, "Look at that disgusting display," and Phoebus goes, "Yes, sir." That makes me laugh every time, and I'll just give Hunchback the win for that. That kind of pushes over the line for me.
So it looks like Quasimodo is going to move on to Ring Bells another week. What do we have coming up next week?
So it's kind of an odd one. We've got Wreck-It Ralph versus Lady and the Tramp.
That is going to be another interesting one. That might be weirder than our inaugural episode.
Yeah, I mean, they're both episodes about people from different worlds coming together to defeat a giant crab monster. I haven't seen Lady and the Tramp in a very long time.
I hope you guys tune in next time. It's probably going to be pretty interesting. Once again, this has been the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast.